In the past couple of weeks, we've done two programs focusing on drug abuse, one on the increase of heroin in the United States, another on the unique challenges of methamphetamine addiction. During both programs, we received phone calls from people at their jobs. A caller concerned that a coworker might be abusing drugs, a heroin addict whispering into the phone so he wouldn't be overheard. The fact is that most adults who abuse drugs or alcohol also go to work. And whether they use drugs in the workplace or not, the impact is felt. By some estimates, American corporations lose billions a year in lost productivity and health care expenses due to substance abuse. Given those numbers, you might think that companies would directly address this problem. Not so, according to a recent survey by the Hazelden Foundation. More than half of human resource directors surveyed said they lack the expertise to deal with this problem. So what can employers do to deal with substance abuse? How far should they go? And what should employees do? Later in the program, the controversy over a doctor's list of patients who've sued for medical malpractice and suspicions of discrimination. But first, drugs, alcohol, and the workplace. If you have a problem, does the workplace feel like a safe place to get help? If you're a former user, does that make it harder to get a new job? If you're an employer, how do you deal with prospective or current employees who might be using drugs or drinking too much? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now by phone from his home in Georgia is Paul Roman. He's a research professor at the University of Georgia who's been looking at this issue for over 30 years. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Let's start out by trying to get a sense of how big this problem is. Is there any reliable way to measure it?
Well, measuring the problem is fairly difficult. You cited some cost figures, which have been frequently cited, billions of dollars of losses. In terms of the actual prevalence of the problem, I would say that roughly... And this comes from a variety of sources. I would make my summary judgment that over a lifetime of employment, roughly 5 to 8% of the workforce is going to experience a significant problem with alcohol or drugs.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there any way to measure the cost of, again, we mentioned some figures, but is that an accurate measure of the cost of substance abuse to employers?
Well, many of the costs, I should say, are hidden costs and very difficult to calculate. For example, a cost that is almost impossible to measure is the extent to which coworkers feel threatened or they feel distressed or they feel in some way upset by the presence of somebody who obviously has some sort of a problem that they don't know about. Their performance is probably affected by living around this problem on a day-to-day basis, but it's practically impossible to come up with an accurate measure of how these coworkers' performance is impacted and how and what the actual cost of that might be. Another area that is very difficult to measure is healthcare costs, because it's very difficult to separate out those healthcare costs of the person who uses drugs, those healthcare costs that might occur anyway versus those that could be directly attributed to the use of drugs themselves. So the cost factor is a very elusive one. I think that I would say that we have found over the course of my research career that the cost deal is not the factor that persuades employers to really get seriously involved in dealing with this problem. What persuades them is an incident or several incidents that occur in their workplace where they observe that the mismanagement of this episode led to tremendous problems and costs and impacts, and they don't want those to happen again. Mm-hmm. So many employers come around to see that the idea of dealing constructively, dealing deliberately, and dealing consistently with alcohol and drug abuse problems is good management. It's good business. And the cost factors kind of dribble away in terms of some kind of shooting match about who has the greater cost and which problem is more expensive than the other.
Now, help us understand a little bit about the employee who's a substance abuser. Is this person likely to be an alcoholic or an addict?
The employee with the so-called substance abuse problem comes in a great many forms, and in the recent past, we've discovered that the forms in which he or she comes are even more complicated than we ever thought previously. In other words, today it's very unusual to have a person who simply uses a single substance, such as alcohol. Most of the folks who are of the age of 40 or 50 today, the baby boom generation, experienced exposure to a variety of drugs in their earlier years, and they're not foreign to them. So you have a pattern of multiple drug use in many, many circumstances, where you have something that is a primary drug of choice and something that's secondary. Coupled with that is the strong possibility that a person also has prescription drugs, which he or she may have legitimately received from a physician, and these drugs may be interacting, compounding, or supplementing the pattern of use of alcohol and illegal drugs. Finally, we have most recently discovered throughout the entire community of researchers in substance abuse that probably half the people who have serious alcohol or drug problems also have a significant mental illness. And whether the substance abuse is a response to this mental illness or it's a consequence of the substance abuse, these things are relatively unknown and difficult to figure out. But the significant point is that the employed substance abuser does not come in a simple package.
Would depression be the one of those?
Depression is a very common disorder accompanying substance abuse, and as you can probably immediately infer, it's very likely that many substance abusers are self-medicating, that they're treating themselves for their depression.
Now, we talk about drugs and alcohol. Would alcohol be far and away the biggest problem?
It probably is, and it's most difficult to deal with because of its availability and because of its legality. Many researchers who've looked at this problem over the years have argued that that the hangover, the alcohol hangover, is one of the most expensive consequences of abusive alcohol use in the workplace, and yet the employer would never even see the employee drinking and may not even know that the employee drinks. But the employee comes to work the day after a heavy drinking episode, or even for shift workers, several hours after a drinking episode has been over, and the spillover effects of the drinking are very significant. So it's hard to underestimate the alcohol, the problem of alcohol in the workplace. Although I think that employers have had kind of a head in the sand attitude toward this for the past 10 to 20 years due to the tremendous emphasis of the war on drugs and the impression that if one dealt with drug abuse through pre-employment screening or whatever, then the problem was solved.
All right, let's get some listeners on the line. Again, it's 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. We'll begin with Roxana in Salem, Oregon.
Hi. I wanted to comment that my mother was an alcoholic, and everyone in my family was also alcoholic. And if somebody had done an intervention at work where they actually had some leverage with her, I think she could have gotten some help. And so I want to say that I think it's just so important for this to be dealt with, because it could actually save a child from growing up alone without a parent.
Yeah, you said your mother was.
Still is. I'm sorry.
Still, I see.
An alcoholic, and she's not working in. She's retired.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Roman, that raises the question, I guess. I mean, certainly we all feel for Roxana and for what happened in her family. But is her employer responsible for this?
Well, the statement by Roxana, to whom my heart definitely goes out, having seen and having had in my own family life, as most of us do, tragedies associated with alcohol and drugs. I deeply sympathize with this outcome. But this plays directly into where I've spent so much of my own career, namely, as Roxana said, there's leverage in the workplace, and the leverage can be used so rationally and so simply, namely that when an employee manifests poor job performance, when they show that they can't show up for work on time or that they can't get along with coworkers or that they can't produce a quality product or that they make mistakes at work, the employer has such a legitimate right to intervene, not necessarily to intervene and accuse the employee of being an alcoholic. In fact, that's a very bad strategy, but to intervene and say, you have a performance problem, and we need to do something about that, placing the onus on the employee to turn the situation around. And most employers don't act, not because they don't want to, but because they don't know how to react. And one, as I just implied, one of the worst things you can do in the workplace is to directly accuse a subordinate or a coworker of having an alcohol or drug problem, because what you immediately do is trigger their denial system and just push their problem underground, plus the fact that the symptoms of a so-called problem are very ambiguous and could be due to a variety of different reasons. For example, somebody, an anecdote I heard recently is that an employee went into the bathroom frequently during work and would come out with bloodshot eyes. Well, you know, if you wash your face, you could come out with bloodshot eyes if you get soap in your eyes. You know, and very likely, whether or not drugs were being used, the readiness of such an excuse would come out. So the point to get back to is that I hope that I'm on accurate ground here, that when Roxana's mom was having these her alcohol problem and was employed, that she was showing some indications of poor work and that there was an opportunity to intervene. But very likely the employer just didn't know what to do and didn't know that the strategy really should be based on performance issues rather than on personal issues. And secondly, that the employee should be held responsible for returning performance to an accurate level with the help of the employer. But not the whole concept is not that the employee should be tolerated and put up with, and that poor performance should be allowed because the individual has a drinking problem. Not at all. The pressure is very much in the opposite direction to shape up. And the tolerance does not last forever. I'm not saying at all that Roxana's mom necessarily would have been a successful case, but we do know from research that I and others have completed that about 70% of people who do go through such a formal process do succeed in getting well.
Roxana, I certainly hope that things are going better for other members of your family.
Well, for me at least.
Well,
that's okay. I'm blazing new territory for my family.
Well,
not coming with me, but that's okay.
Well, in that case, hang in there. It can't be easy.
Yeah, there are a lot of good people out there, so thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the phone call.
Sure, thanks.
We'll be back with more of your phone calls after a short break. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about substance abuse and drugs and alcohol in the workplace. And we'll be back after a short break. We're talking with Dr. Paul Roman, a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cohn in Washington. We're talking about substance abuse and work, and we're taking your calls. Does your place of work do drug testing? If so, does it seem like an effective way to curb drug abuse? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Paul Roman, a research professor at the University of Georgia. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Brian. Brian joins us from Minneapolis.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just want to say that I had an employer who did an intervention on me about 4 years ago. And it really made a difference, even though I don't work for the company anymore, because it got me into treatment. And beyond what my work performance was, in the end all be all, it saved my life. Because on the road that I was on, I don't think I would have had very much longer. And it, for this employer that I had, one thing that I think made it a little bit easier is the fact that I had comprehensive insurance that would cover a treatment program that I could go to.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if that's the choice for a lot of other employers out there, employees.
Well, I we'll get to that in just a second, but what happened after the intervention? I assume you went back to work.
Actually, yeah, I went through a treatment program. They actually contacted members of my family,
mm-hmm.
and there was a larger intervention done, and I gave in pretty quickly at that time. I had been on the go for quite a while using opiate-based narcotics on a hourly or daily basis. And I went back to work and eventually left that job, but I have been sober since.
Congratulations on staying sober, but I wonder what was it like when you went back to work? Did everybody there know what you'd just come back from rehab?
And, pretty much. I think regardless of how hush-hush, you know, people try to keep it, word gets around.
Yeah.
You know, human nature is human nature. But, you know, that's part of – I took that as just part of the gig and part of the consequences of my actions, and, you know, it made me kind of – there was a level of acceptance that I had to come to with that. And that really, looking back on it, wasn't a really my big problem, so, you know, of what other people thought of me, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think it is a lot harder for people who, you know, when you drink alcohol on the job, it's noticeable. But when people are doing things like, you know, in the bathroom or doing, you know, narcotics, you know, intravenously or, you know, orally or whatever, it's a lot easier to hide and it's a lot easier to look at a person and say, well, maybe that's just the way they are, or they're just a little bit different, or they're just kind of weird, or they're just, you know,
yeah.
or they're having an off day all the time, and to kind of rationalize that. It's really hard, and it is a touchy subject.
If you're using something illegal, you tend to hide it anyway. So
yeah, and you tend to hide it. I think it's a lot easier to hide it than, you know, you don't have something on your breath.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. Brian, thanks very much, and hang in there.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dr. Roman, what about the question he raised? Obviously, in his case, the intervention at work did help him. And what about the question he raised about insurance?
Oh, that's such a painful topic, and he is so right. One of the things that has occurred in accompanying the war on drugs in this country in the past 20 years has been a slow deterioration of benefits for treatment that cover substance abuse. And as you may or may not know, the issue of providing treatment coverage that is on par or on parity, as it's called, with other diseases is an issue that so many people are fighting for right now. But we just see very little promise that this situation is going to change. Now, fortunately, I would add quickly that there are a number of self-help programs. There are a number of excellent public programs out there for people who do not have insurance coverage and or who do not have very good insurance coverage. But, of course, with great insurance or with maximum insurance, the whole resolving the issue is made so much more easy and so much more direct.
Let's get another caller in. Bob is with us from St. Louis.
Yes. Hi. My comment is quite simply that companies feel that there is a loss that's going on here. I have went through so many drug testings and been able to skirt around it and get away from the issue and never be found out whatsoever.
These were urine tests?
Yes. I mean, I've literally been coming down off of an amphetamine high and been doing a urine sample, and the test showed up completely negative. I've even had a test where I had used marijuana a few hours earlier. And it was one of the tests where the lines have to show up on the urine test. And the line didn't show up. But the nurse said, I think I see the line starting to come in. All right, that's negative. Okay, good. There's not effective testing out there. I've gotten away with so many drug tests. And whether it be, I mean, I stopped using, when I was smoking a lot of pot, I would use detoxifying teas. But after a while, I just stopped because I didn't need to because the urine sample tests were so inaccurate.
Did you know when these tests were scheduled?
These are usually pre-employment.
Pre-employment tests.
These are pre-employment ones. And, yes, I did have to have some that were because I was an athlete as well.
I see. Well, what about that, Dr. Roman? I know we've heard a lot about false positives in drug tests, but what about Bob's case?
Well, I'm no particular fan of drug testing. I think drug testing serves a very different purpose than what people believe that it serves. Drug testing, for example, doesn't tell us anything about the ability that an individual has to perform a job.
Yeah, but what about Bob's question? Are they accurate?
They are accurate to a certain degree, but there are many ways around the test. He mentioned that he at one point was using a mechanism to get around to come up with a false negative. But
on my last test, I didn't do anything at all and still came out with a negative. And that's
The tests are a biochemical measure, and people's biochemistry varies greatly. And it's a good measure to find out whether someone is practicing the moral code that the employer wants to enforce, because a lot of employers just say, I don't want a drug user in my workplace, regardless of how well they perform or what other attributes they have. The accuracy, the people who, drug testing is a big industry. We have to appreciate that. And the people who sell drug tests have been saying for years and years and years how accurate their tests are. However, we don't have any follow-up of the type that we're hearing right now. No one ever really does any follow-up research with people who've gone through these drug tests to say, hey, were you really a user at the time you came up negative on your drug test? So The data are very skewed and very incomplete.
All right, Bob, thanks very much.
All right, thank you very much.
Kimberly Clark is one company that has been more aggressive than most to deal with workplace substance abuse, and joining us now to tell us how they do it is Dr. Jim Quayle, Vice President for Medical Affairs at Kimberly Clark. He joins us by phone from Dallas, Texas. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before you tell us what you've done at Kimberly Clark, tell us why your company decided to take this on.
Well, it happened as an event. As Dr. Roman mentioned earlier, about 18 years ago, one of our senior executives had a problem with alcoholism, and the CEO at the time was very supportive of this guy getting help and getting treatment. He came back to work and has had a brilliant career at Kimberly Clark. And as a result, the CEO put this recovering executive in a lead role in helping us develop what I think is a sophisticated approach to dealing with alcohol and drugs. So we had a little bit of help from someone who knew a lot about it.
Describe a little bit about that approach, if you would.
We adopted a policy 15 years ago that said we are going to do three things. One is have an ongoing education program for our employees about the disease of drug and alcohol addiction. And I truly believe that the 5 to 8% that can't stop have a disease. It's a biopsychosocial disease. It's fatal. It's devastating. And so we've tried to educate our employees that this disease exists, and when people have it, they really need help. Mm-hmm. The second piece is to have an EAP program that's strong, active, and able to give help and advice to people who are dealing with this, maybe themselves or their families. And then the third piece is the insurance question that you were talking about. We've had to go out and insist that our insurance plans have adequate coverage for treatment for people that need it. So those three elements have been the core elements of our drug alcohol program for the past 18 years.
And when you say EAP, of course, that's an employee assistance program.
Employee assistance program. That's a prepaid counseling program that handles any type of stress that an employee is experiencing, because there's other things besides drug and alcohol that cause performance problems. So what we want is employees who encourage other employees to go for help to the EAP when they are experiencing problems that affect their performance. By and large, fellow employees will know about a person with a drug or alcohol problem before their supervisors will. Mm-hmm. The ideal for us is that person gets a lot of support and encouragement from their fellow workers to go for help before they have a performance problem. That's the best outcome.
Let's get another caller involved. Chris is with us on the line from San Francisco in California.
Hi, yes. I reported the drug problem of a fellow employee, and I was disciplined formally.
In other words, you told somebody's boss that a fellow worker had a problem?
Right. Someone came to me about a frontline employee came to me about another frontline employee and said that he and two other people felt that this frontline employee was stoned on the job. And this frontline employee that was allegedly stoned used to work in my department, and This frontline employee that was allegedly using drugs is working with new customers, so it was of concern to me because of my particular job circumstances. So I went to my supervisor, and she formally disciplined me on paper and said I was being negative and not a team player.
Dr. Roman, is that a does that happen commonly?
Well, I think that it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the safe ground to use in dealing with these issues in the workplace is job performance and not attempts to diagnose a problem or to use some kind of signs or symptoms.
What would you advise Chris to have done then?
I would have advised him to possibly go to someone else in the organization, perhaps in human resources, to get some advice as to what to do. Because think of this: if you accuse somebody of being a drug abuser or an alcoholic, I mean that can be seen as slander.
But just to be clear, I didn't. I went in private to my boss and I said, "This is the report I'm getting. You know, it's check it out." I didn't confront the person directly.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know all the dynamics of the rules in the organization. I would just say that an employer would have to take attention, I would assume, if you had some evidence to say this employee on our staff is constantly away from their workstation, are abusive to customers, they act like a lunatic, they use bad language, et cetera, something that was breaking the rules of the workplace would probably be a better approach than suspicion of a drug problem.
Okay. Chris, thanks very much.
Sure.
As an idea, Dr. Quayle, how would you have handled that at Kimberly-Clark?
Well, first, I commend Chris for stepping forward because most people don't.
Yeah.
Most often it goes under the table and nobody says anything and the problem rocks along and nothing gets done. So I think Chris was courageous to raise the issue, and I think he did it appropriately to his supervisor in private. And hopefully at Kimberly-Clark, the response would be, what are you seeing that causes you to raise this complaint? And the individual would be confronted on the behavior. If the behavior indicated that they were impaired at our company, they could be immediately tested if they came to work impaired. That's one way we use testing, is if someone comes to work impaired and is behaving that way and the behavior is documented, they can be tested. If the behavior is observed by two supervisors, they're taken for an immediate test. And interestingly, if they fail the test, they're given an opportunity to go for treatment. It could be the setting for a workplace intervention that we've talked about earlier. I hope that the supervisor would have listened, thanked Chris for his courageous move, and documented the behavior, and eventually, if not immediately, confronted the problem behavior in the individual and encouraged them to go for help if they have any personal problems. Not saying you have a drug or alcohol problem, as Dr. Roman pointed out, but we think the best drug test is a good performance review system.
We're talking about drugs, alcohol, and the workplace. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear now from Mark. And Mark is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hi. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment. I've been hearing people talking about companies doing interventions and providing treatment, and basically just making them responsible for our personal lives. I don't understand, with a lot of the unemployment that we have and the trouble with people getting jobs, if you're not doing a good job, as one of your guests keeps pointing out, is a performance. If you're not performing well, then you should be removed, regardless of whether it's because you have a drug problem or because you're just lazy. And not to turn this into a legalized marijuana show, but I think very, very poignant to the show. When you test somebody for something like marijuana that stays in your system for 6 weeks, for something that, for an incident of the day, maybe they were behaving strangely that particular day, you're not bringing up any evidence that they're coming to work that way. And again, I'm not advocating the legalization of marijuana, but I have passed the proverbial peace pipe with healthcare professionals, you know, lawyers, professional people who are very good at their jobs and only indulge from time to time on their own time as one would have a drink. And I don't think it's very fair for the testing to come in to knock those people out when we've got others who have, you know, cocaine, amphetamine, heroin problems that are manifesting themselves while they're at work.
All right, Mark, thanks very much for the call. And Dr. Roman, his point is, if an employee's work is impaired from whatever reason, shouldn't that be grounds for whatever, you know, maybe termination, maybe suspension, whatever, and let somebody else do the job?
Well, this raises a legal issue that has been held up in the courts at several different levels, namely that if an individual has a problem such as alcohol or drugs that they admit after their performance problem is identified, and they ask for help or they say, I want to deal with this problem, the employer is obligated to give them the opportunity to seek help. Again, this is a result of some legal judgments that have occurred, the logic being that there is a known technology for providing people with assistance that is often very effective assistance. So there can be, if someone is fired outright for having an alcohol and drug problem, which they admit and ask for assistance, it isn't ordinarily that simple. So I think that giving people an opportunity, or at least doing, as the good doctor was pointing out, some kind of performance management system, this is what makes sense. And, rather than just some kind of abrupt decision that anybody who performs poorly should leave.
And sometimes the culture of the company is at issue. Here's an email from Melanie in Phoenix, Arizona, this past week during a job interview. A potential employer, in trying to get the point across about the corporate culture he's trying to create, asked me, was I a beer girl or a martini girl? This was a well-known international consulting firm, not a bar. Some companies encourage the problem because people in positions of power are addicts themselves and want others on board with them. So another aspect of the problem. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today. Dr. Paul Roman, a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And Jim Quayle, vice president for medical affairs for Kimberly-Clark, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, charges of blacklisting regarding a website for doctors that names patients who have sued for malpractice. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.